From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The reality of the last 3 years is that the white parties have essentially decided against the pursuit of a national agenda. Rather, they have chosen to propagate a reactionary, dangerous, and opportunist position.
South African President Nelson Mandela gives his swan song as head of the African National Congress. And here at home, what happens when Blue Cross Blue Shield goes private? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After a year-long investigation, the Central Intelligence Agency has concluded that it had no link to crack cocaine sales in the United States. This according to the San Jose Mercury News today. Former CIA Director John Deutsch ordered the inquiry after an August 1996 series in the newspaper by a reporter who has now resigned. The series concluded that a San Francisco Bay Area drug ring sold cocaine in South Central Los Angeles, then funneled profits to the Contras for the better part of a decade. The series traced the drugs to dealers who were also leaders of the CIA-run guerrilla army in Nicaragua. The reports generated widespread anger in the African American community toward the CIA, as well as numerous federal investigations into whether the CIA took part in or countenanced the selling of crack cocaine to raise money for the Contras. Unidentified sources close to the CIA investigation said it was the agency's most extensive internal investigation, including several hundred interviews and a review of 200,000 pages of documents. However, some former intelligence operatives apparently refused to cooperate with the investigation, the San Jose Mercury News and the Los Angeles Times reported, quoting two former CIA officers, one of whom was involved in Contra operations. The Los Angeles Times quoted former CIA officer Donald Winters as saying, "Their interview with me was simply to go through the motions of touching all the bases. It was not clear whether or when the public would see any of the CIA report." In an open letter to readers in May, the newspaper's executive editor, Jerry Seppos, said the series had shortcomings. Reporter Gary Webb, who researched and wrote the series, was transferred to a smaller bureau 10 months ago after the series was published. He went on a byline strike, which he reported on Democracy Now! Just a few days ago, and resigned from the newspaper last week. This internal CIA investigation, where the CIA cleared itself, is surely not going to leave many feeling assured. White House officials warned the Voice of America, a government-financed agency, that it should consider not broadcasting an interview with a prominent Chinese dissident now in the United States because it could offend the Chinese government. This, according to officials quoted in the New York Times. The Voice of America, which by law is supposed to be able to make its editorial decisions independently, chose instead to broadcast the interview with the dissident, Wei Jingsheng, into China last week. Officials at the National Security Council, the foreign policy arm of the White House, had argued that Voice of America should consider canceling the broadcast because it could hamper efforts to obtain the release of other opponents of the Beijing government. Before the broadcast, Sandy Berger, the assistant to the president for national security affairs, had expressed concern about the interview to the director of Voice of America. And this is a quite unbelievable story in the New York Times today. Its dateline is Tokyo. One moment they were happily munching on their dinner and watching their favorite cartoon show on television. The next moment, hundreds of children across the country were shaking and convulsing and being rushed to hospitals. In a bizarre illustration of the medical effects that television can have on viewers, more than 700 people were taken to hospitals after having been affected by flashing lights on an animated television show broadcast on Tuesday night. Some children vomited blood, others had seizures or lost consciousness. No one died, though, and no one is expected to. Producers of the cartoon, which is highly popular among kindergarten and primary school children in Japan, say they were stumped over how an animation technique that has been used hundreds of times could cause such a widespread violent reaction. This may be the first case of mass suffering from photostimulation, said Toshio Yamauchi, a professor at Saitama Medical School and chair of an organization called Electronic Screen Game and Seizures. He added, "We would like to study this thoroughly." As cartoon makers push the limits to find new ways to entice children to their programs, doctors and psychologists warn that this episode is a stunning reminder of how vulnerable children can be to certain contemporary television shows. The incident is likely to prompt calls for stiffer controls on cartoons and shows for children. Children across the country arrived at school yesterday with the greeting, "Are you okay?" A third-grade student told a Japanese newspaper, "I felt a little dizzy toward the end of the program." She said she quickly recovered and added, "I'd be sad if I could not watch the program anymore." And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and good day to all of our listeners.
Well, I certainly hope it will be, though for some there is concern all over this country around the issue of health care. And today we're going to take on one of the issues that is of concern to many people, the issue of health insurance. A little noticed but important trend has been transforming the health care industry nationwide, affecting millions of people and promising to affect millions more. State Blue Cross and Blue Shield nonprofits, arguably the most well-known health insurance associations in the country, are slowly being converted into for-profit companies. Here to discuss this are several people. We'll start with Julie Silas. She's staff attorney and policy analyst at the West Coast Regional Office of Consumers Union, which is most well-known for being the nonprofit publisher of Consumer Reports. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Julie.
Good morning.
Well, why don't we start off with you telling us how Blue Cross Blue Shield got started?
Well, in the Depression, many people were not able to get access to health care. The primary source of health care was at nonprofit hospitals. And what you would find is people going to hospitals and trying to pay for their health care with chicken, with pieces of meat. In fact, some nurses who worked in the hospitals were unable to pay for shelter, and they would offer their services free to the hospitals in order to have shelter and food. So you're going through a healthcare crisis at that time. What happened at that time also was that the only way to provide health insurance was through for-profit companies. And what in most states, nonprofit hospitals got together and said, we need to come up with a better way to provide access to healthcare to the community. In most states, there was no law that allowed an insurance company to sell insurance in a nonprofit context. So across the country, new laws were created all over that created a special law for nonprofit insurance. And the special law said that no one could benefit from the business of insurance privately. And instead, these plans would be created for nonprofit charitable purposes.
And how then did Blue Cross emerge as this dominant insurer throughout the country?
Well, here, again, Blue Cross Blue Shield plans were the only nonprofit insurers. So there was a lot of support in the community to build these plans up because, unlike other insurers, when no one could benefit and there was no profit to be made, all the revenue generated from paying for premiums was used to provide access to health care rather than to benefit private individuals. So as more and more people learned that this was a different kind of health plan and that it was more accessible in the sense that rates were less expensive, they weren't experience rated, which means that they rated people at a different level depending on what their health status was. Many of them were community rated, where everyone got the same rate based on whether they were a single person or whether they were a family. So it was much more accessible health care by being nonprofit than the commercial for-profit insurers were.
Now, even though they were nonprofit, I remember my experience in Philadelphia as a reporter then. The Blue Cross and Blue Shield company, while it was nominally nonprofit back in the 80s, even had a skybox at the Veterans Stadium. The expenses that it incurred and that obviously that it charged in its premiums were very akin to those of any major corporate insurer. So this issue of them turning profit, as this didn't happen overnight, did it?
Right. Well, what happened approximately 40 or 50 years, they were clearly grounded in the nonprofit context. But as the healthcare system became more competitive, they became to look more and more like for-profit companies. However, their assets were built as nonprofits, their reputation. The fact that Blue Cross Blue Shield is up there with Coca-Cola in terms of name recognition was built because it was uniquely different from other insurance companies. In the mid-'80s, the federal government said that these plans look just too much like for-profit companies, so we're going to remove their federal tax-exempt status. However, they didn't fully remove it. They created a special category in recognizing the nonprofit history and the community benefits that people had gotten historically from Blue Cross Blue Shield plans. So many of them, not fully federally tax-exempt, still get special treatment compared to other commercial for-profit companies.
Well, I'd like to bring in Mark Scherzer, who's the Legislative Counsel for New Yorkers for Accessible Health Coverage. And welcome to Democracy Now! He's here
with us in
the studio in New York. And I'd like to ask you, what are the ramifications of this sudden transformation of many of these Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans from nonprofits into for-profits, and what are the legal questions that citizens should be concerned about?
Well, the ramifications are going to differ depending on what state people live in. In many states, including New York, for years, even after the Blue Cross plan began to look more like a for-profit company with its executive perks and whatever, it still had a special obligation as the insurer of last resort, meaning that when commercial insurers rejected people or small groups that wanted to buy insurance because their members were too sick, had poor health histories, people could go to Blue Cross and get coverage at a community rate that did not discriminate against them. So you lose, potentially, in many places, the institutional commitment of a particular insurer to insuring everyone without discrimination, regardless of their health history, which is what we think insurance ought to be about. And many would argue, however, that changes in the law have made that role more or less irrelevant because with federal reforms recently and with many state reforms over the past 5 years, all insurers have begun to be required to take people regardless of the state of their health. And consumer protections have been enacted more broadly across the marketplace. So what we're losing is an institution that was fulfilling a particular role, although we have distributed that role somewhat more broadly across the spectrum of insurance companies. The legal questions you want to ask, I think, are whether you are losing particular benefits that the Blue Cross system provides that other systems that are existing do not provide, and what you have to do to ensure that those functions are picked up elsewhere.
But what about the assets that were supposedly accumulated because of their nonprofit status and obviously tax benefits that are accrued therein? What happens to these charitable assets now when you become a for-profit company?
It's been a subject of much controversy in many places across the country. We've been fortunate here in New York that the Blue Cross plan, when it proposed to convert to for-profit, recognized that its assets were charitable assets, and committed to giving the full value of the company at the time of the conversion to a foundation, which we've been successful in advocating to have a role in increasing access to coverage and access to care. In other states, including nearby in New Jersey and Connecticut, the Blue Cross systems have very aggressively taken the position that they are not charitable assets. They put the state and consumer groups in the position of pursuing those assets to ensure that they are committed to the public good. But it's by no means a battle that's complete.
We're talking to Mark Scherzer, Legislative Counsel for New Yorkers for Accessible Health Coverage, in the studio with us, Julie Silas on the phone with us from the Bay Area in California, staff attorney and policy analyst at the West Coast Regional Office of Consumers Union, and also on the phone with us from Denver, Mary Bolin, Vice President for Catholic Charities in the Archdiocese of Denver. She chairs the Colorado Healthcare Conversion Project, a coalition of some 31 advocacy groups. Mary, can you tell us about what's happening now in Colorado around the issue of Blue Cross Blue Shield going private?
Well, we've had a series of hearings before the Commissioner of Insurance this fall, and we're awaiting a ruling on the first part of those hearings, which had to do with the foundation issues and the impact on the citizens of Colorado. About in 1996, the state of Colorado passed legislation to regulate the conversion or sale of nonprofit healthcare companies. And so Blue Cross is the first company in Colorado to try to move toward for-profit status under terms of that statute. And they have to prove to the satisfaction of the commissioner that it will not have a deleterious effect upon the subscribers or the citizens of Colorado, and there has to be fair market valuation of the company. That second set of hearings starting in January will deal with the value of the company, and those are likely to be fairly contentious hearings. But where we are at the moment is we've completed the first set, which has to do with where the what the assets, how the assets will be conveyed, and to what kind of an entity. They're proposing a foundation, and there's been a considerable body of testimony around the impact on subscribers. In addition, it's been a bit complicated because prior to filing for to move to a for-profit company, Blue Cross of Colorado acquired Blue Cross of Nevada, and so the Nevada citizens have entered into the hearings as a party contesting that some part of the value of the company belongs to the citizens of Nevada. So it's gotten very complicated.
And Julie, Silas, when these foundations are created, if citizens are successful in at least sheltering some of those charitable assets, what do the foundations do with this money?
Well, the goal from a community perspective is to ensure that the foundations continue to use the assets to provide access to health care for vulnerable populations. In some states, when hospitals have converted, they've created foundations, yet there have been some questions about what those foundations have used the assets for. And oftentimes it's been interpreted that it's okay to use those assets for things other than health care. But both the coalition in New York and the coalition in Colorado are working hard to ensure that the assets from the Blue Cross Blue Shield plans are used in those foundations for healthcare purposes. I do want to say, however, that Colorado and New York are unique in that both of the Blue Cross Blue Shield plans are acknowledging their charitable obligations. But across the country, that is not always the case. In, as Mark stated, in New Jersey, in the state of Texas, in the state of Kansas, in the state of Missouri, in the state of Connecticut, the Blue Cross Blue Shield plans are fighting through litigation, through public relations campaigns, against preserving their assets for charitable purposes, and really moving to take those charitable assets that were built up in nonprofits into the for-profits that they become, so that private individuals and private investors and shareholders and executives will be able to benefit from those nonprofit assets that were really built up on behalf of the community.
Julie, Silas, could you talk about the victory that happened in California over the last few years as Blue Cross Blue Shield went private?
Sure. It actually was the Blue Cross plan. Here in California, there are two separate plans. And the Blue Cross of California plan decided to do what they called was a restructuring. And they moved a tremendous amount of their assets, more than 80% of their assets, into a for-profit subsidiary and said it was a restructuring and that, therefore, it wasn't a conversion. They didn't have to preserve the assets for nonprofit purposes. The regulators approved the change and the creation of the subsidiary, but later on said, what are you doing to uphold your charitable purposes? You still have a nonprofit. What is it doing? And in the process of an acknowledgement that there continued to be a nonprofit and it had full charitable obligations, the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan decided that, okay, we'll set aside $100 million over a 20-year period to preserve charitable assets. And the regulators and community groups said, that's not enough. You have to preserve the full value of the Blue Cross Blue Shield company for charitable purposes. And as that dialogue continued, in 1996, Blue Cross set up two foundations, nonprofit foundations, and distributed more than $3 billion to of those two foundations.
Quite a difference from their initial offer.
That's correct.
From zero to $3 billion. Well, we're going to continue this discussion in just a minute. Julie Silas, our guest from San Francisco area, staff attorney and policy analyst at the West Coast Regional Office of Consumers Union, the nonprofit publisher of Consumer Reports. Mark Scherzer in the studio with us in New York, legislative counsel for New Yorkers for Accessible Health Coverage. And Mary Boland on the phone, vice president for Catholic Charities in the Archdiocese of Denver. She chairs the Colorado Healthcare Conversion Project. We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue this discussion of Blue Cross and Blue Cross Blue Shield going private around the country. Our guest, Julie Silas of Consumers Union, she's based in San Francisco. Mark Scherzer with us in New York, legislative counsel for New Yorkers for Accessible Health Coverage. Mary Boland joining us from Denver, where she is vice president for Catholic Charities at the Archdiocese there and chairs the Colorado Healthcare Conversion Project, a coalition of more than 30 advocacy groups. Juan?
Mary Boland, I'd like to ask you, we've talked a little bit about the financial implications here. I'd like to ask a little bit about the moral issues involved here. Increasingly, as healthcare in America has become privatized, we've seen these burgeoning scandals that have enveloped the healthcare industry. Obviously, the Columbia healthcare situation. We've had Oxford Health Insurance now in a tremendous tailspin because of its inability to live up to its increasing market share. What are the moral issues involved here in such a huge operation like the various Blue Cross and Blue Shield operations beginning to head in a for-profit direction where obviously there are going to be conflicts between the need to increase profit for their shareholders versus the need to provide the quality health care that people need?
Well, there are a number of concerns. One of the things that we've seen in the you mentioned the hospital conversions. One of the things that we've seen is a decrease in the amount of care for indigent people. We've had clinics that were underwritten by the nonprofit hospitals that no longer are receive funding. We saw very aggressive competition by the for-profit sector for the Medicaid dollars because they now recognize that there are some money to be made in that area. So we're very concerned about a growing gap in accessibility to health care. There are about 600,000 Colorado residents today who cannot get access to health care. And the one hospital that provides the majority of care for indigent people is Denver Health and Hospital Systems here in Denver. And so if you think about the state of Colorado and the geography with the mountains and the very rural nature of this state, there are loads and loads of people out there who can't get care at all. And as we see the conversion to for-profit medicine, we have major concerns about a kind of a subsection of our population who aren't getting subsidized by government benefits and who are not being subsidized by their employer, who just don't have access to care at all.
And Mark Scherzer, in New York and in your group, what kind of examples are you coming across of this issue, this problem of accessibility?
Well, we have a similar problem of growing numbers of uninsured because of people unable to afford the premiums for health insurance and small businesses being unable to afford those premiums. And of course, when you have an institution like Blue Cross that was committed to keeping premiums down in order to cover as many people as possible and that disappears, that's of concern. We have more specific concerns. Our coalition is a group that represents mostly voluntary health organizations, people with serious illness. We have several hundred people who are locked into Empire Blue Cross because they're on Medicare and can't buy substitute insurance if they lose their Empire coverage. And they rely on that Empire coverage for prescription drugs, which are not provided by Medicare. A lot of people with AIDS in that category. They are concerned, very concerned, that when Empire converts and no longer has a legal obligation to cover them, keep them covered, because we've got a state law that requires them now to be kept covered by Empire, they'll have no place to go to get substitute coverage and could be really up the creek without access to the drugs that they need to keep themselves healthy. So there are many people who have relied on various programs of Empire, these being perhaps the most poignant example, who are concerned that those programs may disappear when Empire becomes a for-profit company.
And Julie Silas, in terms of the lack of media attention to this issue, given there's been lots of media attention on the increasing problems with HMOs, but very little to this privatization movement within Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Why do you suspect that that's so?
Well, I think it's a very complicated issue for people to understand, and I think you touched on it earlier when you stated that, well, Blue Cross Blue Shield plans have become to look more and more like for-profit companies. And so when they're going to convert to for-profit, it really doesn't look that different than how they've been performing. But as you've heard today, really, there is a fundamental difference between a nonprofit and a for-profit, because a nonprofit isn't owned by anyone, and no one can privately benefit from a nonprofit. And its purpose really is to continue to use any assets or revenue or profit that's generated back into the nonprofit for the nonprofit purposes. By contrast, you have the for-profit that its purpose, its fundamental purpose, is to maximize profit for its investors. And it can be owned by people. In fact, that's the nature of a for-profit, and people can benefit from it. And when you talk about it that way, and when you make people and communities aware of what the implications are, that individual investors are going to reap windfalls of assets that were really built up on behalf of the community, then it's easier for people to understand. But it certainly is a challenge to make people more aware. I think we've seen a progression of communities becoming more aware of the implications and regulators. In fact, in the last couple of months, a number of regulators have filed lawsuits against Blue Cross Blue Shield plans that had converted a number of years ago and did not preserve their assets, and looking back to those plans to say, you should have preserved those assets, and we're going to hold you accountable to preserve them now.
Is there any way to deal with this at a federal level rather than having to go state by state with each one of these individual plans in the state legislatures? Is there a possibility for some sort of federal legislation that might be able to address the problem?
I think because of the unique nature that each state created its own special law to cover these Blue Cross Blue Shield plans, and the law that requires a nonprofit to preserve its assets for charitable purposes is also uniquely a state law. And so because of that nature of how the plans have been governed, their history, as well as the law that's developed to preserve those assets, they really have been treated as on a state-by-state level.
I would agree with Julie with respect to preserving the assets, but I would say that we need to be looking to federal law to do more to protect access of consumers generally to health coverage when the Blue Cross systems do go for profit.
Mark Scherzer, as we wrap up the discussion, I wanted to ask you about your own clients in New York, people who have dealt with Blue Cross and Blue Shield, some personal stories.
Well, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, because it was the dominant insurer here in New York, tended to have the dominant share of the problems with their patients. And Blue Cross for years has, in fact, been, some people would say, until recently, much less amenable to giving people access to state-of-the-art treatments than its commercial competitors were. But on the other hand, Blue Cross created some of the most innovative programs, and I think particularly of my clients with AIDS, who had something called the At-Home Options Program, something Blue Cross created as an extra beyond its contract that allowed people to get care at home rather than in the hospital through visiting nurse service in a really very sensitive way. And that's a program that's been lost, and one wonders whether there's going to be an insurer with the sort of institutional commitment to do that in the future.
I'd like to bring Mary Boland back into the conversation from Denver. As all of these plans continue to head into the private market, does this put increasing pressures on organizations like yours, Catholic Charities, and the health care that the Catholic Church provides to Americans?
Well, I think there's a real responsibility on the part of the nonprofit sector, and one of the to continue to maintain its historic mission of care for those who can't afford care. One of the challenges for us, I'm working on a task force appointed by our state attorney general to draft legislation that would regulate the sale of hospitals now, and that'll be introduced in this next session. And one of the challenges we faced is how do you regulate the conversion or the sale of nonprofit hospitals and not impede, and there's a strong sentiment to include nonprofit to nonprofit transactions as well. How do you create legislation that provides for public oversight and public accountability of those nonprofit institutions without at the same time preventing them from consolidating in the way that they have to consolidate in order to maintain market share and remain viable? So we have a lot of concern about preserving the viability of the nonprofit sector as medicine becomes more and more competitive and the for-profit entities get larger and larger and multi-state. Blue Cross Blue Shield, the president of Blue Cross Blue Shield testified that he anticipates that health insurance will get down to about five large companies, at least in the Mountain States regions. And that's a real concern to us, is how do you preserve the nonprofit sector in the face of that kind of for-profit competition?
As you all try to deal with Blue Cross Blue Shield going private, have any of you simply fought it, as opposed to getting as much money as you can once it goes private, actually fought its ability to go private?
In many, many states, people are fighting their conversions of the nonprofit hospitals to try and preserve those nonprofit hospitals. It's a little bit more difficult to fight the Blue Cross Blue Shield plans because of the level of competition in the for-profit sector. However, oftentimes, if you create a standard that says, if you want to convert, you have to do it this way, many times that is fighting the conversion because they do not want to convert and preserve the assets, and therefore they just don't convert. An example is in Blue Cross Blue Shield Mutual of Ohio, which wanted to go into a relationship with Columbia HCA, the prominent for-profit hospital. And the community there fought very hard to ensure that they would preserve the assets, and Blue Cross refused to do such a thing. And as a result, the deal fell through. And that also has occurred in New Jersey, where the plan there was attempting to convert to for-profit and then merge with another for-profit mutual insurance company. And the regulator said, well, you're a charitable organization. And Blue Cross Blue Shield, the nonprofit Blue Cross Blue Shield, has used a tremendous amount of resources to go to court to fight that they're a charitable organization, and they've lost every step of the way. Yet at the same time, they're using a tremendous amount of nonprofit assets to fight that battle. And we question at whose expense, probably the community's.
Well, on that note, we want to thank you all for joining us and want to give out some phone numbers. Julie Silas, staff attorney, policy analyst at West Coast Regional Office of Consumers Union, which puts out consumer reports. Do you have a number people can reach?
We have a number where community groups who want assistance from Consumers Union can reach us, and that number is 415-431-6747.
That number is 415-431-6747. And in the Rocky States region, Mary Boland, Vice President for Catholic Charities in Archdiocese of Denver.
Our number is 303-742-0828.
That's 303-742-0828. And on the East Coast, Mark Scherzer with New Yorkers for Accessible Health Coverage.
We're at 212-367-1240.
That's 212-367-1240. I want to thank you all very much for joining us, an extremely important subject, and it's one we will continue to follow. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to an international issue, we're going to go now to South Africa. In his final speech as head of the ruling Africa National Congress this week, President Nelson Mandela of South Africa warned the world of an effort by former apartheid rulers to intensify a destabilization campaign against South Africa's new democracy. In the four-hour speech delivered before 3,000 delegates at the ANC's 50th National Conference in South Africa, Mandela also accused elements of the white minority of seeking to retain their privileges, saying that when any meaningful changes were attempted, such as the use of affirmative action, whites, quote, consistently demonstrated their desire to maintain the status quo. In a few minutes, we're going to play an excerpt of that speech, which we managed to get very early this morning from Johannesburg, from the South African Broadcasting Corporation that recorded the speech. But right now, we're joined on the telephone by Marcus Mabry. And Marcus Mabry is the reporter with Newsweek in the Africa Bureau in Johannesburg. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Marcus.
Thank you very much.
Can you just give us a brief sense of the significance of President Mandela's swan song speech before the ANC?
Well, I think what Mandela was trying to do was sound a clarion call to South Africa and to the world at large, which often I think has a tendency to think that the struggle in South Africa is over because blacks now have the vote and apartheid is dead. I think Mandela was trying to say that what he sees as the greatest challenge for this new generation of leaders, which he has welcomed to the top of the ANC as this conference has, as the ANC has celebrated its 50th annual party conference, he's trying to issue the warning that their greatest challenge is going to be that of real economic empowerment. Blacks now have political empowerment in South Africa, but economically the country looks much like it did in the days of apartheid. There's a very tiny black middle class. The great mass of black people are poor. And he's trying to say that this battle to empower the majority is actually going to be a tougher one, perhaps, than the liberation battle. There are going to be many forces, many white conservative forces, who will try to maintain the status quo, because to do otherwise would mean a loss of their privileges.
And is your sense that Mandela's speech, in essence, signaled the coming of perhaps a more confrontational approach, especially by his successors, in terms of dealing with some of these problems with the white minority?
No, actually, you know, I think it's actually the opposite. What I expect, Thabo Mbeki, who has taken over now as head of the ANC from Mandela, and who most likely will be elected president in elections in April 1999, is actually not at all a confrontational figure. Thabo Mbeki himself is a very conciliatory. He was actually one of the leaders of the ANC in exile who initiated the first talks in West Africa during the days of apartheid with white business leaders, saying that, look, something must change in the country to save both your interest and ours and the nation. I think, in fact, Thabo will be incredibly conciliatory. I think what Mandela was doing, though, was letting the white interests know, particularly white corporations, that in order for South Africa to avoid chaos in the future, then they're going to have to voluntarily do some things to help to alleviate poverty, to give job skills to the unskilled workers that are the majority of the population right now. I actually think it was a warning that Mandela and his successors hope whites will heed in order to avoid a coming chaos. And I think Mandela was trying to give Thabo a kind of card to use in his coming talks with white business leaders. And I think Thabo, as far as offering an olive branch, went out of his way to say yesterday that in the next few weeks he will have meetings with prominent white business people in order to kind of alleviate their fears, but also to come up with ways that they think creatively they can help South Africa to become a more equitable society.
And so Thabo Mbeki will replace President Mandela as president of the African National Congress, and of course we do assume that in the election he will also become president of South Africa. And Winnie Mandela, at the same time, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, the former wife of the president, a political leader in her own right, refused the nomination for the post of deputy president.
Well, what actually happened, Amy, was that Winnie Mandela realized that she did not have the floor support to get her name on the nomination list for deputy vice president. What she realized was the fact that she was far short of the 700 and something delegates needed of the total 3,000 to actually get her name placed on the ballot. So she withdrew, realizing that defeat would have been certain.
Well, we want to ask you why that happened and why you think, very briefly, of course, we have been following the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings that Winnie Mandela appeared before, but we do have to break. Marcus Mabry is with us. He is a reporter in the Africa Bureau of Newsweek, speaking to us from Johannesburg. When we come back, we'll finish up our conversation with Marcus and then go to an excerpt of President Nelson Mandela's speech. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about South Africa. On the phone with us, Marcus Mabry, who is a reporter with Newsweek in the Africa Bureau in Johannesburg. The latest developments, Nelson Mandela stepping down as president of the African National Congress, Thabo Mbeki succeeding him, and Winnie Mandela realizing she would not get the vote she needed for the nomination for the post of deputy president. Marcus Mabry, the events of the last few weeks, is that what changed things for Winnie Mandela before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, I think, Amy, the events before the testimony before the TRC was very damaging to Winnie Madikizela Mandela. But at the same time, I'm not certain that even before the scandals and the accusations against her, alleging that she was involved in things from kidnapping to torture to murder, during the dark years of apartheid, I'm not even sure that even before those things came to light, if she, in fact, would have been given this phenomenal accolade to be nominated or and indeed voted as deputy president of the ANC. Most people here realize that that would be, you know, that would put her a breath away from being deputy president of the nation. And many people in South Africa, even supporters of Winnie Mandela, told me after the hearings, that, you know, they're just not sure she has the stature for that. She is still the beloved mother of the nation, despite the airing of those allegations last week and the few weeks before that. But at the same time, they're just not sure that they want her to lead the nation. And I'm not sure, even without the TRC, that she would have been nominated for that post.
Let me ask you about aid groups. In just a second, we're going to hear Nelson Mandela talk about foreign support for local groups and getting wise to who has support, popular support, and who doesn't, and how that is having an effect on the government of South Africa.
Well, I think in large part it's true, as Mandela said, that the perceptions outside of the country and those inside the country can be starkly different. As I said, most people outside South Africa think the struggle is over, but it really the hardest part is only beginning now. And I think Mandela would certainly hope that those who receive funds and aid from outside of the country will be those who actually are going to have a demonstrable effect to help to empower, to educate the black majority, which today is still incredibly disadvantaged in this country.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Marcus Mabry from Newsweek in Johannesburg, as we now go into the speech of Nelson Mandela that he gave on Tuesday, more than 4-hour speech before the ANC, the African National Congress's 50th National Conference. In fact, he starts out about talking about aid groups. He later in the speech, a part we do not play, will refer to the U.S. Agency for International Development, talking about how, in some respects, it may makes Mandela's task more difficult. But he talks about this. He talks about the Nationalist Party, and he talks about other issues. South African President Nelson Mandela.
We must make the point that our experience of the last 3 years points to the importance of non-governmental organizations, community-based organizations, and grassroots-based political formations in ensuring popular participation in governance. The effective and admirable way in which many of these structures have functioned has served to emphasize the point that in many instances, the public service, however efficient it may not be the best instrument to mobilize for popular involvement and participation. However, we must also draw attention to the fact that many of our non-governmental organizations are not, in fact, NGOs, both because they have no popular base and the actuality that they rely on the domestic and foreign governments rather than the people for their material sustenance. As we continue the struggle to ensure a people-driven process of social transformation, we will have to consider the reliability of such NGOs as a vehicle to achieve this objective. The success achieved by many community-based organizations, CBOs, based on the contribution of sweat equity by very poor communities points to the need for us seriously to consider the matter of the nature of the so-called organs of civil society. Another matter relevant to the aim of entrenching and deepening democracy is the unresolved question of the role of traditional leaders, especially in the context of the establishment of a democratic system of local government and the impact of traditional African society on the formation of the new South Africa. The departure of the National Party from the Government of National Unity in 1996 also brought to the fore the contradiction that derives from the need for the various political formations in our country to act together to promote a national consensus in the context of and as opposed to the felt imperative of especially the minority parties to act on their own account in order to maintain their individual identity in the eyes of the electorate. Clearly, the promotion of the concept of united national action, designed to bring together all political parties so that we can ensure the greatest unity around the fundamental issues facing our society, must therefore also take into account the desire of these parties not to be seen as lackeys of the ANC. During these past 3 years, it has been a basic tenet of our approach that despite our people's achievement in stabilizing the democratic settlement, we are still involved in a delicate process of nursing the new baby into a state of adulthood. This has required especially of the principal political forces that we agree on a common multi-party agenda of transformation, that these forces would advance and defend in the interests of the medium and long-term future of our democratic, united, non-racial, and non-sexist country. Accordingly, each one of these forces would, as part of this agreement, promote this agenda even when its particular constituency felt that such an agenda did not serve its immediate interests. Institutionally, this found expression in the concept of a government of national unity, reflected in the composition of the executive and the leadership of the legislative structures at all three levels of government. The reality of the last 3 years is that the white parties have essentially decided against the pursuit of a national agenda. Rather, they have chosen to propagate a reactionary, dangerous, and opportunist position which argues that a normal and stable democracy has been achieved, that the apartheid system is a thing of the past, that their legitimate responsibility is to oppose us as the majority party, thus to present themselves as elements of a shadow government which has no responsibility both for our past and our present, and consequently, that they have a democratic obligation merely to discredit the ruling party so that they may gain power after the next election. The delegates will readily recognize the fallacy of these arguments. They will draw on their own practical experiences, which will have demonstrated to all of us how much this approach, driven by partisan interests, undermines the effort to consolidate and establish a non-racial, non-sexist, and prosperous democracy in our country. As we have said, the issue of how to address a commonly defined national objective in a united manner, while protecting the identities and public appeal of the separate political parties and formation, remains a matter which only the future will be able to resolve. We have failed to achieve this result during the last 3 years. The answer to this and other undecided questions must form part of the policies we elaborate at this conference to ensure that the important victory of the liberation movement to establish a democratic order serves as a basis for the defense and advancement of our revolutionary gains. We would also like to report that during the last 3 years, we allocated a particular responsibility to the presidency, and therefore the necessary capacity to ensure that the entirety of our government forces focuses on the questions of the emancipation of women, youth development, the rights of the child, and the empowerment and development of the disabled. We took this decision because we are convinced that forward movement in these areas is central to the very nature of our democracy and is not a mere matter of partisan political programs. It has been a fundamental feature of our policy for many years that ours could not be a genuine democracy unless the complete emancipation of women was an inherent part of any process of democratization. It is critical that this commitment should find expression in actual programs that address the gender question in a way which enables us to measure progress actually achieved. We are therefore pleased that in the last 3 years, we have succeeded to establish the Commission for Gender Equality and the Office on the Status of Women in the Presidency, as well as adopt as government the Beijing Platform of Action dedicated to the goal of the emancipation of women. Similarly, responding to the other matters we have mentioned as being fundamental to the very nature of our democracy, we have established the National Youth Commission within the Presidency, which has now elaborated a national program for youth development, established an office on the status of the disabled, again within the Presidency, and adopted the first ever white paper spelling out an integrated policy for the upliftment of the disabled, and ratified the International Convention on the Rights of the Child, and constituted a permanent interministerial committee on the rights of the child, headed by the Presidency. These matters will continue to receive the focused attention of the government as part of the defining feature of the people-centered democracy we are committed to create. We will return to some of the issues raised in this section under other sections of this political report. I see. Well, my boss here has given me instruction, and I must obey.
We will just take a short break to allow the president to drink some water properly.
And that was South African President Nelson Mandela giving his final speech as president of the ruling African National Congress, giving that speech in the northwestern town of Mafeking, South Africa. The conference, the 50th National Conference of the African National Congress, continues through today. If you would like a cassette copy of today's show, you can order it by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. That speech of Nelson Mandela's was given on Tuesday in South Africa. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our engineer, Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And if you'd like to reach us, you can send us email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.